Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with environmental writer Bill McKibben. He's been with us on this program before a number of times to talk about some of his books, including The End of Nature and the Age of Missing Information. He's a former staff writer for The New Yorker. He's written for many national publications, including Arts Outside, Rolling Stone, Harper's, The New York Review of Books. He was born in California, in Palo Alto. He went to school at Harvard, and just about as soon as he graduated from Harvard, he was hired as an editor at The New Yorker. And at that point, though, after having been there for a while, he became unsatisfied with the pace of life in New York City. He quit his job there at The New Yorker and moved with his wife to an isolated house in the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. And that was the point we started thinking more and more seriously about the issue of the environment, and that led to his writing the book, for which he's probably best known, The End of Nature, that was published in 1989. We'll be talking this morning about his most recent book. The title of that book is Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. It's come out fairly recently, published by Simon Schuster. And in the book, he explains that for a lot of his life, he never thought of himself as being particularly athletic. But it was after his move to the Adirondacks that he became introduced to the pleasures of doing things outdoors, like canoeing and hiking and cross-country skiing. And that as he started to approach middle age, he made the decision to see just what his body could do and decided to spend a year training as an intensely competitive cross-country skier. And part of the book is that story, the story of that experience. Also, though, after he'd been into this for some time, another challenge came along, a very significant one, when his father was diagnosed with cancer and was told that he would probably only live for about another year. All of this is addressed in the book, and it's very well written, so you might want to look at it. It's certainly in bookstores now. And as we talk here with Bill McKibben, your questions and comments are also welcome. All you have to do to be a part of the conversation is to pick up the phone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. McKibben, hello.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about your what happened when you moved from New York City to where you live now and you're discovering the attractions of doing things outside.
Well, you know, I'd always liked the outdoors, but I was living in a place where that's what there was to do. Where there wasn't anything else to do but learn to love the woods and the lakes and the rivers, and of course I did. And, you know, that had been the sort of background of my life for a decade. Most of the time I was busily engaged in writing about and working on environmental issues, the work that basically is still my life's work. But at some point, as you indicated, I was beginning to burn out a little bit. My my complete failure to save the world was becoming overwhelming, and it was time to do something else for a little while. And this book was supposed to be a complete vacation, in a way, a vacation in a sense from thinking. I was going to be as fully present in my body as it was possible to be for a year. As it turned out, both because of my nature and because of what was going on in my life, it actually turned out to involve a good deal of thinking as well as a lot of running and skiing and weightlifting. In a way, this book turned into a kind of meditation on endurance. And maybe in some ways that's what would be of most interest to your listeners. And in a way to me, there's so many people around this country who have made the paradoxical commitment in their life to, you know, be up at 6 in the morning running in the streets of Champaign or skiing and getting ready for the Birkebeiner or whatever it is, And, you know, it doesn't exactly, it's a kind of countercultural thing almost at this moment in our instant gratification society. But the pleasures of it are very real, and they came to interest me a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly do have, at least that I know of, a couple of world-class athletes here that we have kind of come to know, a wheelchair athlete and a skater that have become fairly famous and well-known. And I just, in fact, recently talked with the wheelchair athlete about some of her experiences, the only person ever to win the Boston Marathon 8 times. Mm-hmm. And it's something that she, and one of the things that I guess came through in that interview was the kind of determination and the fact that while you might say that this person is somehow physically or spiritually gifted, and I imagine that they are, that you cannot underestimate the amount of sheer hard work that, and in her case, it was time spent lifting weights and time spent, on this set of big rollers, just rolling as fast as she possibly could for hour after hour after hour.
That's right. Unlike certain sports, unlike sprinting, which you either are good at or you're not, and really there are very few, there are not very many masters sprinters, because what's the, sort of pleasure of just proving that you're slow time and time again. Endurance sports, things like running marathons or rolling them in a wheelchair, cross-country ski racing, running 5Ks, whatever it is, those are incredibly interesting because they can be just as completely competitive for people like me who aren't genetically endowed to be very fast. But, for every race that's going on at the front of a marathon, there are 1,000 other races going on back in the middle. Sometimes it's people just striving to finish. But in other cases, it's people who are trying to go as fast as they possibly can, even though they're nowhere near the lead, who are, battling with the limits of their own ability to tolerate pain and discomfort and to make themselves go when at some level you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely interesting world. And one of the things I discovered, my whole life I've been a piss poor meditator. I've tried. I've read books and had people try to get me to meditate, and I can do it. I'll try to do it for a while, but my mind just chatters away, and it's extremely hard for me. There were moments, long moments sometimes, an hour at a time in the middle of a really engaging race, when my mind was totally there for that hour, when I was totally present, which is a pretty rare thing for me anyway, and I think really for an awful lot of us. And I think that must be one of the charms that keeps people doing this sort of atavistic activity.
Well, and it seems very clear, as you write about it, that having experienced that, you said to yourself, I want to get into that place again.
I'd like to be back in that zone. Yes, and it's usually to some degree the same zone that you're in if you're being very creative. If I'm writing something that's going particularly well, the world drops away. But, boy, is it intense when you're just, all you're doing is everything you can to keep track of your body and figure out, just how to be right in that line, going as hard as you can, but not going so hard that you drain everything and bonk. It's a completely interesting place to be.
Yeah, I've talked a couple of times with Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who has written about this.
Oh, yes.
I think he's the guy that coined the phrase or the term flow for this state, you're taking on a challenge that is a real challenge. It demands a great deal of you, and yet it's not something that is so big that you can't really do. So it's something like it just gets you kind of right to the edge of what you're capable of.
Endurance sports, since you do them, since almost none of us are actually going to win the Boston Marathon or any other marathon, there are, everybody can rise to the exact, right to their edge. And a lot of the times you don't. A lot of the times you fail that challenge, or at least I do. Your just mind is not there that day. You just can't make yourself, and no one else watching from the outside would know. You might only be a minute slower than you would otherwise be in the course of 10K or something, but you know that you weren't able to make yourself do it that time. And that can be a pretty discouraging feeling, too.
I should introduce again our guest at this point, Bill McKibben. His most recent book is Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is in part an account of this year that he spent in this intensely athletic activity of trying to gear up to be a competitive cross-country skier. It's also about his experiences dealing with the death of his father and how those two things kind of came together. It's in bookstores now. It's really well written. And, of course, if you'd like to talk with our guest, you can do that too, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Your dad's illness was something that came on apparently very suddenly. There was no indication
That's
that
right.
It would happen. It was like a bolt out of the blue.
August of that summer, he'd been hiking hard in the Cascades. We're a family of hikers. September, he came to visit us up in the Adirondacks, and I noticed he was sort of lurching around a little bit. We thought maybe he'd had a tiny stroke. We got him to an MRI in a couple of days, and they found that he had a wickedly fast-growing brain tumor. There was nothing to do but try to operate immediately. The operation was not particularly successful. He entered a steady and swift decline that killed him within 6 months. It was the most horrifying 6 months of my life, but it was also incredibly rich time. He learned a lot. He taught me an awful lot. And it, you know, on the one hand, there was something obscene about carrying on with this project of mine. I mean, here I was carefully calibrating the increase in my vigor at the very moment that we were also carefully calibrating the decrease in his. On the other hand, it was a great relief to have something mindless to do every day, get up and have 4 hours of running or whatever the day's schedule called for. And also, it made much, much deeper and more complicated my understanding of what endurance was all about and what its limits and virtues and limitations were.
Yeah. He was obviously dealing with what he was going through. Did he know? Obviously, when you started out, he knew about what.
Oh yeah,
no,
he knew
doing.
About it all the way along. You know, his mind stayed pretty good. He couldn't talk very easily, but he was, you know, until the very end, until he sort of went into the final set of comas, he was alert and completely interested and enjoyed hearing what was going on. But what was more interesting was to watch him make the slow transition into another place. It was as if he knew he was embarking on a different kind of journey and preparing for that. And I learned, you know, if endurance sports is an awful lot about just sheer doggedness and persistence, then one of the things that watching someone die a good death is about is learning both the value of that sort of persistence and doggedness, but also the value of a kind of grace that lets you let go as well.
It's the kind of sentiment that I've heard expressed by other people and I have read, and it seems though something I'm sure for people who have not gone through it to be a difficult idea to accept, because it seems that we in our culture, we fight the idea of dying so hard. And then when we get around to talking about dying, then it seems that more and more we talk about how what the idea would be is for people to simply close their eyes and fall asleep and go. And the idea of there being some virtue or something to be learned in suffering for the sufferer and the people who witness that, that seems to be a really hard thing to accept.
Yeah, well, I think it is. And one of the things that we were quite blessed with was that a brain tumor, for all its debilitating effects, at least in this case, and I think in many cases, doesn't produce pain. And so my father wasn't in physical pain. There was an enormous amount of discomfort that came from not being able to move and, you know, all that went with that. So he was, and we all were able to to have that time to kind of get ready, each in our own way. And one of the things I discovered was that he quite enjoyed and wanted to be able to talk about the process of dying. I think that's probably true of a fair number of people who are dying, and that we may do them a disservice by, to the extent that we pretend it's not happening or only bring up cheerful subjects or whatever it is. We had a number of extremely fascinating conversations, and ones that in many ways were very helpful and to me, you know, as I look ahead and think about the end of my life, to see the degree of both persistence and peace that he managed.
It seems to be the case that when people get into middle age, it's probably the first time in an individual's life that they can really contemplate with some sense of reality their own mortality.
I think that's probably right. I started this project when I was 37. I decided, boy, this is the last moment when my body's going to work, you know, when there's any hope of it working with full effect. It was like, you know, the last call at a bar at 3 a.m. someplace. You know, this was it, and it was amazing to see my body respond. I mean, it really is true. I mean, in fact, at any age, your body still responds to exercise and taking care of it. But it was quite amazing to sense what reserves of strength there actually are in a human body that you don't know about unless you have the time and the inclination to do the work to bring them out. And it really is, you know, it's not a matter of anything except sheer hard work. I had this terrific coach who drew up for me a plan of what I should do when. So for a year, every morning when I woke up, there it was, the computer printout. Today you're going to run for 2.25 hours, and then you're going to lift weights for an hour. Tomorrow you're going to cross-country ski for 3.5 hours and then do wind sprints the next day, you know, so on and so forth. And, boy, it doesn't take very long before you're physically a different person than you were when you began.
And I think one of the things you write about in the book is that when you got the this fellow who would help you out, he figured out that what you could do and what you would need to do was 600 hours of training spread over a year.
600 or 700 hours, which is right at the sort of low end of what Olympic athlete, endurance athlete might train. But, of course, they've been doing it for a number of years. They have a real base to work on, and so that was as much as we thought my body could possibly hack, and I think that was just about right. There were moments when I felt like I was about to crumble under that, but I made it through, and, you know, without injury, and by the end, I was one of the culminations of the book, you know, takes place in Norway, where I ended up at probably the greatest cross-country ski race in the world, the Birkebeiner. It is about a 60-kilometer race over three mountains in the north of Norway. One of the most grueling things you can imagine doing on a Saturday, but also one of the sweetest.
It's sort of surprising, and I mean, I sort of wish you well. I'm glad that you didn't have any major injuries, but given how hard you were training, it seems a little bit surprising that somehow you managed to get through all that without.
Yes. Well, one of the things was as possible, I was cross country skiing. Much of the rest of the year, I was either running or better roller skiing. The great virtue of cross country skiing is that it's probably the most aerobically difficult thing to do in the world, because it really requires, you know, you're moving every muscle in your body. On the other hand, it's probably the sport that's easiest on your joints in the world. There's no impact, and so it's not at all remarkable if you're in Norway, say, to see 90-year-olds out there skiing hard. Their bodies just haven't, which, you know, you just can't, I don't think you could do that much running in your life and not pay for it, but you can do that much cross-country skiing because it doesn't bang up your knees, and it does, you know, none of the parts of the human body that are badly engineered get much stress in cross-country skiing.
I know that some not very many years ago, people thought that this sport in this country was really going to take off for a variety of reasons, because it's really good exercise and people were interested in that, and the equipment's not terribly expensive and you don't have to have a mountain. And for a lot of reasons, people thought, hey, well, this is going to be the next big thing. And somehow it never was. Why did the Nordic skiing in this country, you think, never quite grab on?
Two problems, I think. One is that it requires a lot of exercise. And, you know, when you get right down to it, we really aren't that. I mean, as a culture, we've become, I think, less interested in some ways in exercise. But more than that, it requires winter. And the last 20 years have, you know, we've had some off and on, some good winters, but for the most part, we really haven't. It's gotten harder and harder to find good snow. And I'm afraid that intersects all too neatly with my real life's work, which is on global warming issues. It's abundantly clear that winters have become shorter, less severe, that there's less snow cover across this hemisphere, that you have to go further up in altitude to get reliable snow. The people who sell cross-country skis around the world are convinced that this is the single biggest reason that their sport is beginning to dwindle.
Hmm. Well, it's certainly the case around here that over the past quite several years, you just simply hear where we live, you couldn't. This year, yes, you could. Because
this year's a pretty good year.
It's
last
been a
year,
good year.
Unfortunately, the American Birkebeiner, which is the biggest race in this country, in Hayward, Wisconsin, they had to cancel it for the first time in its history. There just wasn't any snow.
You write in wonderful detail about your training and the regimen that you went through, and also about the mystique of equipment. And probably once somebody gets deeply into anything, you start to get seduced by the stuff. And as you sort of get better and you get into it, you start thinking more and more about how wouldn't it be great to have whatever is a more advanced kind of thing. And in this case, it would be better skis or better poles or that sort of thing. And I'm sure that for competitive skiers, that those things do make a difference. How much difference does that make? And for somebody who is sort of a mid-level person, if you got really good skis, is that going to make a big difference?
Yeah, it depends. I guess it sort of depends how far you're going to go. I mean, better equipment in this case basically means lighter equipment, lighter in everything. And so for skiing through the woods, there's no advantage and in some ways a disadvantage to get more and more expensive and high-tech and lighter equipment. Just fine. I mean, I do an awful lot of my skiing on skis I've had since junior high school. But if you're going to race, and you're going to be going, 50 kilometers as hard as you possibly can, you really don't want to be, picking up an extra 3 ounces every time you pick up your pole. Over time, that'll tell on your arms. And so there's no question. Everybody who races, becomes obsessive. One of the things I was trying to write about was that, I've spent an awful lot of my time, because I work on environmental issues, really worrying about the degree of materialism in our society and in my own life and trying to cut it out. And yet there was this, just green-eyed ferocity with which I wanted carbon fiber poles and whatever it was. And I sort of, the way I rationalized it to myself was to say, everybody in their life is going to have, hopefully, one thing at which they're really good enough to notice the difference between, I cook dinner every night, but I'm not a great chef, and I don't need, the most expensive pot and pan ever made. The ones from, Kmart are going to do just fine. I drive, but I don't really care that much about driving. I certainly don't need an expensive sports car, so on and so forth. But I do ski now well enough that I really do notice those extra 3 ounces on each ski or whatever it is, and just and love the absolute wonderful material, the absolute wonderful gear. usually we're sort of advised by the advertisers and things to work the other way around. You know, go get the great gear and then you'll get great at whatever you're doing. I don't think it really works that way.
Mm. I like your discussions on wax. Skiers apparently spend, in one point in the book you write here, in the brain of a committed cross-country skier, wax occupies the amount of space allotted to sex in a normal mind. Perhaps sex and money both.
When you're doing classic skiing, if you want to move, you have to, you know, there has to be some way to kick this ski and make it glide across the snow instead of just slip, instead of just spin your wheels. And the way that you do that is you put wax on the bottom. Unfortunately, the wax changes depending on the temperature of the snow and the composition of the snow. So a good cross-country ski racer carries around a tool chest filled with dozens of tubes of different color waxes. And he carries around a thermometer and perhaps a humidity testing device, hygrometer, is that what they're called?
Uh-huh.
And all sorts of other things to enable you to try to pick just the right wax. Then you go and you get it in the bottom of your skis and it's working beautifully and you ski the first 10 kilometers of a race and then it warms up a degree and a half. And all of a sudden your wax doesn't work anymore at all. You're either slipping or you're accumulating snow underneath your feet at every step or whatever, and it's never ending. That's why they invented these waxless skis, you know, with a sort of fish scale pattern on the bottom. They're perfect for everyday use, but they're just too slow to race on.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Bill McKibben. He's written a number of books. He's probably best known for his book, The End of Nature. Another that we discussed on this book is on this program is The Age of Missing Information. He's a former staff writer for The New Yorker. He's written for many other national publications, too, Outside, Harper's, New York Review of Books. His most recent book, the one we've been talking about here this morning, is Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. It's published by Simon Schuster and is this account of his deciding to get serious about cross-country skiing. And questions, of course, are welcome. We do have somebody right here ready to go. Others, if you'd like to talk with our guest, you can give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, use that one, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. A couple questions. Did you do classical or skating?
Well, I did both, but what I love to do is classical skiing. What about you? What's your...
Classical.
For those of your listeners who aren't skiing aficionados, for 1,000 years, people cross-country skied in the sort of traditional way that you're used to seeing them, kicking and gliding their skis going along parallel to each other. Then about 15 years ago, people began to do what's called skate skiing. It's pretty much what downhill skiers do when they want to get back to the lift line. Push off with either skate from side to side, and you're sort of swinging your body almost in a pendulum-like motion. It's faster, it's very exciting, but you have to have a groomed track to do it in. You can't go off and do it out in the woods in deep snow. Both of them are great fun, but skate skiing, which I've done and raced doing and things, I think requires even more aerobic capacity. And boy, the last 100 feet of a long hill when you're skate skiing up it seems like it's never ever going to get there.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask, was comparing the two. What do you think is technique-wise is easier to learn?
They say that, when people talk about cross-country skiing, they always say, well, if you can walk, you can ski, which is not really true. I mean, if you can walk, then you can walk on cross-country skis. It takes a certain amount of effort to learn either one of them. Most people learn to classic ski, and then they learn to skate ski. I think that to really, really become adept, it's probably the classic skiing is even harder to get really, really good at. But for the most part, skate skiing is the province of racers. and really serious skiers, and most people do classic skiing most of the time.
When you did the Birkenbeiner, what did you do?
That in, when you do it in Norway, it's entirely a classic race.
It is.
The Norwegians are very big on classic skiing. And in fact, it was great fun because there you'd be. This is a race. This is this race in Norway, and it attracts about 10,000 Norwegians for this unbelievably grueling race.
Were many of them carrying the pack?
You all have to, everybody has to carry a pack.
Right.
3.5 kilos to, mm-hmm. Because this race commemorates
soldiers,
14th century people who rescued the infant king of Norway and carried him on skis across the mountains. And so since he weighed 3.5 kilos, you have to carry that. And it's quite inspiring because you're up there. You're, you know, first of all, 10,000 people, given the population of Norway, is the equivalent of like 2.5 million people or something showing up for the start of the Boston Marathon. It's a very, very fit country. And then you get out there and you're skiing along, and you look over and you realize that a lot of the people you're skiing next to who are doing this unbelievably grueling trip are 80 years old, 85 years old. A lot of these men were out there, you know, during the war on skis, picking up Allied airdrops out in the woods. I mean, the Norwegians, you know, the Germans didn't know how to ski. The Norwegians did, and they controlled the countryside as a result, at least in the winter. It's a very moving thing to see what a lifelong sport it is for a lot of folk.
Did you do that race competitively or just to...
Yeah, but I missed the wax, and so I didn't do as well as I probably could have, but I finished in the top half of my age group, which I figured, considering all the rest of them were Norwegians, I considered it a moral victory anyway.
Okay. Well, it's just an enjoyable show. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for calling. And others, if you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Bill McKibben, here again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I would imagine that even before you started this, that you were probably, now you can correct me if I'm right, you were probably more fit maybe than the average person?
Well, I'm afraid in America at the moment that's not...
That's pretty... I know, that's not saying much.
Walk to the corner to catch the bus, you're probably a little bit ahead of the game. But, yeah, to some degree. But I'd never engaged in competitive sports of any kind. And that was one of the things that made it interesting. In fact, my interest in sports in general had waned. I hadn't watched sports on TV for a long time, and you know, the whole kind of sports culture, is the commercialization of sports and all that, had really turned me off for quite a while. And it was really refreshing to discover that there was this whole other world of endurance sports where even the best people at them, you know, I mean, I could tell you the names of the five best cross-country skiers in America, and no one would have heard of any of them.
Yeah.
Where there was this just this mass of other people who were doing this very difficult thing for the sheer love of it. And there really are a lot, you know, between running marathons and skiing long distances and things. There's a pretty sizable subculture of masters athletes out there, of people who've kept in shape or gotten back in shape, and who take seriously, but not professionally, their sports.
We have some other callers here, and we have a couple of people on cell phones, so we'll get to try and get to them first here. We'll start with line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm calling from southern Indiana, and we've got our first measurable snow that would probably support cross-country skis, but my question was in regards to the Nordic Track fitness machines. How effective are they in general with regards to an aerobic exercise program?
It's a terrific thing to do because it exercises both your legs and your arms. It's also pretty good for getting ready for cross-country skiing, although the motion's not exactly the same, but it's not too far away. But anything, I mean, probably the two best kind of machines you can get for your house for training in aerobic training are either a Nordic Track or a good rowing machine, a Concept 2 rowing machine, something like that, because both of them require both your legs and your arms, your whole body, to get in on the act.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
All right, thank you. And again, here we'll go to line number 1. Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Hello there.
How are you this morning?
Terrific. How are you?
Great. I'm a little frustrated, though. I'm a runner and a mountain biker, and with the snow on, I find I can't get my exercise this morning. I learned to cross-country ski in the military, pulling a 200-pound Akio. I'd like to forget those days, but once I get back into cross-country skiing, can you give me an idea of what I need to buy equipment-wise, length of skis, type of skis, things of that nature?
Sure. How tall are you?
I'm 5'11", about 180 pounds.
Yeah, okay. The key thing is to go to a decent ski store and get someone just to fit you out, because you do want to ski. You want classic skis. If you just want to use them purely for exercise, you know, just casually, get the kind that don't require wax, the waxless skis with the fish scales on the bottom. And those you can order through the mail pretty reliably. If you're going to wax, then it's pretty, you have to get a pair that your weight and body size will compress about the right degree. And there's a little machine that they'll have at the ski store that'll show you the right one. But look for just any good pair of fiberglass skis, wax or waxless. And they really, it's not that expensive given sporting goods today. For a couple hundred bucks, you should have an outfit that'll last you the rest of your life.
Very good. As far as ski length, what would you recommend for someone my size?
About 190 centimeters, I think. 190 or 200.
Very good. Well, thank you, and it's been a great show.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go back here. I'll pick up another person here in Normal, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. One of the previous callers actually asked the question about the Nordic track that I was going to ask. We're going to be retiring in a couple of years, and instead of going south, we plan on going up to an area where we have a cabin near the Canadian border, Minnesota. So sounds like Nordic track might be the way to start getting in shape for cross-country skiing. But one other comment I had was how advantageous you think it was to you to have this intense physical program, exercise program, while your father was sick and you were going through all that intense stress.
I think it was absolutely wonderful.
Right, and we were kind of unable to keep up an exercise program, and I ended up having some autoimmune diseases resulting from that, I think, you know, that just all that stress builds up.
I mean, for me, my work is as a writer. And I think when you're in, at least for me, when I was in that kind of situation, there was no way I was going to sit down and write anything. You know, if I sat down and tried to be quiet for 20 minutes, I was in tears or whatever. And it was a great relief to just have this, to every day get up and have someone, 2 hours I'm going to be doing this. And at least it beat enough out of me every day that I was able to go and
physical relief.
Yeah. And, you know, I watched my mom, who really was dealing with all this, she didn't have any outlet like that, and it just, you know, the stress of it, you know, it was just took an enormous toll on her more than it did on any of the rest of us.
Well, thank you very much. Your book, The End of Nature, was excellent.
Thank you.
Get this one, so thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Bill McKibben is our guest. He's written a number of books dealing with environmental issues, and indeed The End of Nature is one of them, maybe the one that he's best known for. He's former staff writer for The New Yorker. His work has also appeared in a lot of other places, including Outside and New York Review of Books and Harper's and Atlantic Monthly. His most recent book, the one we're talking about this morning, is Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. That's the subtitle, published by Simon & Schuster, and it is indeed about his decision to take a year and to train very hard and very seriously to be a competitive cross-country skier. And he talks a lot about that, and also something that happened at the same time, 9 months into his training, and looking forward to what he'd be able to do with his body. He got the news that his father had cancer and would only live for another year. So in part, it's also about that experience. And it's a good book, so you might want to look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things I wanted to ask you, and I would have gone to, but I wanted to get these callers in, was whether you could talk a bit about how your body felt different once you had, you know, when you're comparing how your body felt to you when it was you were really at the peak of your training, mm-hmm. if you can compare that to how it felt before you started.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was just this, I mean, partly one of the things you realize quickly is that the link between the body and mind is very strong. And so really when you ask that question, what you're really asking is, what does your mind feel like, or what does your mind perceive your body can do? And what my mind felt like was incredibly confident. You know, there was nothing, you know, you told me to go run for 4, 5, 6 hours, no problem. I could do it. You know, it's funny what happens with your body. One of the things that changes quickly when you're doing exercise at that level is that you just... you become skinny, gaunt. I'd never been particularly fat, but all of a sudden there was a lot less of me than there used to be. And this despite the fact that I was eating 4 and 5 big meals a day, you just can't put on enough, can't take in enough calories. And my I was up at the Olympic Training Center in Lake Placid at the beginning and at the end of this project to go through all kinds of physiological testing and some of it incredibly sadistic and unpleasant. But one of the things they did was measure your body fat. And boy, my times for 25 kilometers never got to world class range. But my body fat was right there with the best of them. By the end of all this, somebody, a friend of mine who's another endurance racer, came up and pinched my skin once on my bicep or something, said, "Hey, dude, you have bat skin."
That was a great compliment.
Absolutely.
Let's take another caller here.
Anyone ever said.
And, all right. We'll go to Champagne here, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah.
You said that it took 600 or 700 hours over a year to do the training.
Yeah.
Well, about what does it take to maintain it?
Well, I'm down to about 300 hours now, and I don't think I'm pretty close to where I was, but not right at the same pitch. I think that, you know, the people who are real world class athletes keep up that level of training as long as they're in competition. Even 300 hours is a lot for most people, and would seem like an awful lot. You know, there are plenty of people who race successfully on less training than that, 150 hours a year, something like that. It's important not only the number of hours, but how smartly you use them. And you need the real mix of what they call long, slow distance training, which really does change your body. It increases the capillarity of your body. You get more plumbing in your body, in essence, more veins and capillaries to drain lactic acid from your muscles. You need to combine that with a certain amount of real high-intensity workout. Today, after we do this program, I'm off to do the hardest part of every week, which is the hill intervals, and I'll go and do probably four 10-minute intervals of hard uphill running with my heart rate up about as high as I can make it go. You need that kind of stuff too. One of the accessories that all endurance trainers do need to pick up, a piece of gear that really is quite interesting and helpful, is a heart rate monitor. They're not very expensive now, and they really give you a kind of instant feedback on whether you're working too hard or not hard enough. And help you figure out what zone to be in.
Okay, so it's something like an hour a day, 6 days a week, if you do it smartly.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
But probably much better to have 1 day a week when you do 2 hours or more, and maybe toss in an extra rest day, and a certain amount of strength training can be in that, and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh. Okay, and I've read that even chess players find that they do a lot better when they're in fit condition. Have you noticed that yourself? That
absolutely. I mean, there's everything you do from you know at a certain level benefits from having your body able to draw on reserves. That's really what you're teaching your body to do, is go longer before it begins to bonk. I think it's helpful in pretty much everything. You don't need to go to the kind of extremes that I was talking about unless you want to go do endurance racing. But, boy, I think it's pretty clear by now that basic fitness is awfully good for almost every activity.
Uh-huh. Could you give a ballpark estimate, you're 40% better at riding?
No. I'm not sure that I'm... writing is a screwy enough activity that I'm not sure I'm any better at it at all, and I'm not sure whether I may be losing brain cells as quickly as I'm gaining muscle. So who knows?
I see. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. You talked about the fact that part of this story is about your learning about, thinking about endurance, and it seems that there's also sort of this parallel story of sort of what you were going through and what your dad was going through as he was dying. What, as you think about it now, what do you think you learned from watching him?
Oh, so many things. A good death is it's a real privilege to get to observe. More than anything else, I think I learned the coherence of identity, that it's in those moments that someone who's, life doesn't, it's not that it's transformed, it's that its essence comes out all the more powerfully, that you really, really begin to sense who someone is at the deepest core. And it was in this case, a pretty inspiring thing to see.
Yeah, I've begun to think that more myself, too, and maybe that I've seen it, that one of the things that illness does is, rather than making you a different person, it makes you more of the person that you already are.
I think that may well be.
And now that is going back to the sort of your discussion with the last caller, it sounds as if now, having done this, having been very, very serious about training and getting to this level of fitness, that it sounds as if it's something that now that you can't not do. You're always going to. That's now. Is that always going to be a part of your life?
I hope so. Not at the same anything like the same level, but yeah, there's a there is the sort of sense that there'd be sad to lose that well-being, that sense of well-being. So I hope I'll always have the circumstances that allow me to, knock off for 45 minutes or an hour most days and do a little running or skiing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
And I think that it's a terrific book.
Well, I'm very grateful. And thanks to all your callers.
Our guest, Bill McKibben, and his book, if you'd like to read it, is Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously, published by Simon & Schuster. It's just been out a few weeks, so you certainly can find it in the bookstores right now. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Take care.